The headlines: Iran's president says the 2015 nuclear agreement is a done deal and that no changes to the accord are acceptable. The Yemeni military launches two consecutive attacks on a Saudi Aramco oil facility in Jeddah and a major military base in Asir province. Defiant anti-coup protesters returned to cities and towns across Myanmar a day after dozens were killed in the deadliest day of the junta's crackdown. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has warned the U.S. not to waste time and lift the anti-Tehran sanctions immediately in order to prepare the grounds for negotiations.
We resisted U.S. sanctions for 3 years and have been patient in the face of U.S. violations of the JCPOA by the former U.S. administration. If the new U.S. government wants to make up for Washington's past mistakes, we have paved the way for them. The U.S. should first lift the sanctions and join the JCPOA, and then we can hold talks. Please don't waste time. I stress that wasting time is not in favor of anyone.
Rouhani said the Islamic Republic will come into full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal once the sanctions are lifted. He noted that the JCPOA is a done deal and will not be changed. He also underlined that diplomacy is the best way to resolve disputes regarding the International Atomic Energy Agency. Rouhani called on the agency not to politicize Iran's nuclear program. He said Tehran is ready to resume any inspections under international law if its demands are met. Political analyst Heinz Gertner says the full implementation of the JCPOA will bring more stability to the region.
We have a window of opportunity, and a window of opportunity can close soon. Rouhani, the president, negotiated together with his foreign minister Zarif 2015 in July the JCPOA, and there were an enclave for 3 weeks, so they didn't walk away from the negotiations because they all knew if they adjourn their talks, the window of opportunity that at that time could be closed again. So they finished the talks, and the result was the JCPOA. And if you remember, before the JCPOA was concluded, we had a very unstable situation in the Gulf region. And after the JCPOA has been adopted, there was a very stable situation until President Trump withdrew from the deal. So at that time, we had an ideal combination because President Obama was prepared to talk and to negotiate the nuclear deal, and President Rouhani was prepared. So, and now we have tensions in the Gulf as well, but we have a window of opportunity as well.
The Saudi war on Yemen continues to rage on despite the worsening humanitarian situation in the Arab country. The new U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has pledged to end the war, but has taken no serious step yet in this regard. Here's a report.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015, hoping to bring former President Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi, who had resigned and fled the country, back to power. But with nearly 6 years into the war, Saudi Arabia has achieved none of its goals, and the war has left no choice for Yemenis but to resist. In the latest development, the Yemeni army launched a missile attack against an Aramco oil facility in Saudi Arabia's Jeddah on Thursday. The army also said it had successfully hit the King Khalid Airbase in the kingdom's Asir province using drones. The attacks come in reaction to Saudi Arabia's ongoing war, despite Washington's pledge to end it. U.S. President Joe Biden ordered to halt arms sales to the kingdom to stop them being used in Yemen. However, Biden pledged to continue supporting Riyadh to defend its sovereignty. Analysts say the U.S. continues to transfer arms to Saudi Arabia under the pretext of selling defensive weapons.
When Joe Biden stated that he was not going to sell offensive missiles and weaponry to Saudi Arabia, that is what we call gobbledygook, because a weapon can be both defensive and offensive.
Besides, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson defended his country's continued arms sales to Saudi Arabia. He also stood by his government's decision to cut aid to war-torn Yemen by half, citing economic strains from the coronavirus pandemic. Yemen says the humanitarian situation resulted from the Saudi blockade has even become worse after Biden took office.
Actually, since Biden has took office, Saudi has blocked all ships that come in from Hodeidah, especially oil tanker. And this is actually has not happened during Trump administration.
The UN had appealed for $3.85 billion to fund urgently needed humanitarian programs in Yemen, but only $1.7 billion was offered at this year's donor conference. The UN described the pledges as disappointing and stressed that cutting aid would mean a death sentence for Yemeni people. Yemen relies on imports that have been badly disrupted over the years by the Saudi-led war and blockade. According to the World Body, the war on Yemen has created the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. A recent report showed some 16 million Yemenis, or more than half the population, is going hungry. Of those, 5 million are on the brink of famine. The UN stressed that the only solution to end the crisis in Yemen is ceasefire and a political solution. But considering the current stance by the West toward Yemen, it seems the U.S. and its allies do not want the war to stop anytime soon.
The fiancé of assassinated Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi has called on a Turkish court to consider a recent CIA report as evidence and to hold the Saudi crown prince responsible for the killing.
We filed a request. We will follow up the process with the lawyers. The report that was published puts responsibility directly on the Crown Prince. In this regard, I request that this is included in the court process here.
Changiz made the request after a trial session on Khashoggi's killing in Istanbul. The trial was held in absentia of 20 Saudi suspects, including two former aides to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Last week, the United States declassified an intelligence report that publicly accused bin Salman of approving Khashoggi's murder in the kingdom's Istanbul consulate in 2018. Despite the revelation, Washington stopped short of applying sanctions on the Saudi crown prince. A barrage of rockets has hit the Ain al-Assad airbase in western Iraq, which hosts foreign forces, including U.S. troops. Security sources told Press TV that two American contractors were killed and six others injured in the attack. They said the type of the 10 rockets that targeted the base was similar to the model of the ones used by resistance forces between 2006 and 2010. According to the sources, the attack also caused material damage to the position of foreign forces inside the base. There's been no claim of responsibility so far. Also on Wednesday, Iraqi media reported three separate attacks on the convoys of the U.S.-led coalition. The Pentagon said Iraqi officials are investigating the attacks, adding that the U.S. won't shy away from a response if necessary. Political commentator Scott Bennett says U.S. military presence in West Asia is unjustified.
Well, of course, the United States shouldn't even be in Iraq. It shouldn't be in Syria. It has no business being there whatsoever. It's been a terrible fiasco and a ruinous adventure, which the Zionists and the neocons and the military-industrial complex originally launched after the fraudulent 9/11 attacks, which were part of this Odin and On plan to expand the political geography and control of Israel and the Israeli Zionist U.S. hegemony over the region. And I think the entire region is absolutely sick and tired of nearly 20 years of bellicosity and bloodshed by the United States, which has done nothing but ruin the Middle East. And the only hope of healing the Middle East is through the people and tribes and bloods that live there and letting them rejuvenate themselves by removing the toxic poisonous presence of the United States.
The Hague-based International Criminal Court has opened a probe into possible Israeli war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. During our News Review show, we discuss the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen.
Thank you. overview, the International Criminal Court has opened a formal investigation into Israeli war crimes in the Palestinian territories. The ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Ben Souda announced the probe, assuring that the court will take a principled, nonpartisan approach in discharging its responsibilities. Palestinians have welcomed the decision, with former Minister Riyad al-Malki calling it a long-awaited step. He said the move serves Palestine's tireless pursuit of justice. However, Israel has strongly opposed the ICC decision. Last month, the Hague-based tribunal ruled that it does have jurisdiction to investigate crimes committed in the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and Jerusalem outlets. The ICC is set to look at Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, its settlement activities, and the regime's deadly response to anti-occupation protests in 2018. Hoda Araf is a Palestinian activist and attorney and also co-founder of International Solidarity Movement, who joins us from Detroit. We also have Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Edinburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. Hoda Araf, let me first start with you. This move by the ICC is obviously very welcome. Do we have you? Okay, great. Obviously, it's very welcome by the Palestinians. The PA has already given a reaction to this. But first of all, you're looking at things that have happened years ago. So the first angle of my question is why so late, though it's welcomed? And based on statements coming from a reporter earlier, she said that when it comes to this actually materializing on the ground, that's going to take a couple of years. Is that how you see it?
Well, indeed. I mean, it's a historic day in a decades-long Palestinian effort to get international justice and accountability for Israel's crimes, because Palestinians have not been able to get justice anywhere else. Certainly, they are not allowed to prosecute Israelis in their own courts. Israel does not consider Palestinians worthy to pursue their... They usually don't even investigate crimes against Palestinians, and in the rare occasion that they do investigate, 99 times out of 100, they shut the investigation down. And so Palestinians have been trying to get some kind of justice. In terms of why so long, well, if you'll remember, Palestinians tried to join the court many years ago, and the court did not, before Palestinians were recognized as a state by the United Nations, and the court could not rule on whether or not Palestinian was allowed to join. That was in 2009. Then in 2012, Palestinians secured the recognition of most of the countries of the world at the United Nations that recognized Palestine as a state, and then Palestine acceded to the Rome Statute, which is the charter of the International Criminal Court. So in 2015, the prosecutor said Palestinians launched a complaint and asked the prosecutor to look into these crimes, and it took the prosecutor 5 years until the end of 2019 to say that there is reasonable reason to believe that crimes have been committed. And then she asked for a ruling from the pretrial chamber as to whether the court would have jurisdiction. And that decision just came out on February 5th of this year. The pretrial chamber, in a 2-1 decision, ruled yes, that the International Criminal Court would have jurisdiction in the areas in the territory of the West Bank, including Jerusalem and Gaza. And so this has been a long process. There has been a lot of pressure on the court to not pursue this, which is something hopefully we can get more into, and there will continue to be pressure. And now starts the investigation phase, and the ICC does need states, including Israel, to cooperate with it. And Israel, of course, already said it would not cooperate. So it's still going to be a challenge, and I think many years before we see anything.
And Mick Napier, when you take a look at the whole notion of cooperation, that is where this may hit lots of snags, as we have seen Israel been able to maneuver itself out of this. Well, first, by just rejecting any type of cooperation. So do you think that as much reception this may be getting from Palestinians, from the PA, from maybe even the world, that it's not going to materialize into much?
Look at the positive side first. You could be forgiven for looking at the record of the ICC by thinking that they only try African war criminals. European war criminals and American war criminals don't ever seem to darken their doors. So it's a remarkable development that Fatih Ben Souda has decided to continue the investigation into Israeli war crimes.
Now, you might ask, why is it taking so long? Why do they admit that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and that not that Israel commits war crimes, but Israel is a crime scene. Israel is a place of displacement, mass murder, apartheid, land theft, and so on. Why does it take so long? Because that's the way the world is. But it's still.
It looks like we may have lost you. All right, let me turn to you, if I may, Ms. Araf. Okay, one second. I think we got McNeppy back. Sorry about that.
Yeah, sorry, I don't understand that. Ashkenazi, the Israeli foreign minister, denounced Ben Suda in the court today, saying that this was bankrupt. Now, it's remarkable because Ashkenazi was in charge of the building of the apartheid wall in Palestine in the years leading up to 2004, and that's when the International Court of Justice ruled that the apartheid wall was a crime, that it was illegal, and that not only Israel, but all the other states affiliated to the court were enjoined to demand damages for the Palestinians. Of course, nothing happened. Instead of damages, instead of pressure on Israel, my own government and others simply increased arms sales. So the ruling is fantastic. It collocates the two words Israel and crime together in the eyes of the world to a greater extent, but it won't come to anything any more than the Durban Declaration that Israel was a racist, that Zionism was racism in 2001. Israel and the USA then mobilized massively to reverse that. They will certainly be working massively to build on Trump's sanctioning of Ben Suda in the court. So it's a really good development, but it will only bear fruit if there's a massive international campaign to make it bear fruit.
Sure. Okay, I wish we had more time. Thank you very much for that, Raf. Palestinian activist and attorney, and also co-founder of International Solidarity Movement. Many thanks for your comments. McNeppy, a pleasure. Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign from Edinburgh. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in.
Also around, Taiku protesters have returned to the streets of Myanmar despite the junta's brutal crackdown that left nearly 40 people dead on Wednesday. Protesters in the cities of Dai Wei and Yangon condemned the crackdowns and demanded the return of civilian rule. People also flooded the city of Mandalay while fighter jets were flying over their heads. Similar rallies were held in a number of other cities. The UN Special Envoy on Myanmar has described Wednesday as the bloodiest day since the military takeover of the country on February the 1st. Over 50 anti-coup activists have been killed and some 1,200 detained since then. The army seized power over allegation of voter fraud in November's elections. It also detained civilian officials, including the de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing The House on Cocoa Road, directed by Damani Baker. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Telegraph, The Guardian, and many others. And alongside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, The House on Cocoa Road is the story of director Damani Baker's family, particularly about his mother's story, Fanny Houghton, who moved her children from Oakland, California, to participate in the Granada Revolution, only to find her family in harm's way of a U.S. military invasion. This film also sheds light on the history of black power movements and their struggle for racial equality.
I call the United States home, but this country has a painful legacy of violence that we still struggle to confront.
I think we always have to find something that holds a promise, and that way we look toward the future.
You're committed to humanity, to making the world a better place. You know, not just for your family, but everybody's family. We were trying to make sense of this world.
One of the most important things that has to be done in the process of carrying out a revolutionary struggle is to merge the personal with the political, where they're no longer separate.
You have this situation where we are trying to build a new society.
Grenada is the southernmost of the Windward Islands in the West Indies.
Here's our revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
It was a utopia.
And the next thing I knew, she was packing you all up.
Grenada, we were told, was a friendly island paradise for tourism. Well, it wasn't. It was a Soviet Cuban colony being readied as a major military bastion to export terror and undermine democracy.
I took my young children out of my country to come here to help this country. I left in pain. This is the first time I've been back, so you've got to be very sensitive.
I remember you asking me, as the bombs dropped and the island shook, you said this must be what they call war.
There is a freedom tide rising in our hemisphere. The spirit of democracy is assuming its rightful role as the great unifier of the people.
The shooting! The shooting!
My mother always said that this is not the way things are supposed to be. And if we work towards change, conditions will become different.
Long live peace in our Americas and in the world. Forward ever, backward never.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for joining the show. Now, this documentary gives you an insightful and historical look at race relations in the U.S. and also offers an alternative look at the U.S.-led invasion of Grenada, but from a black perspective. And Mike, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on this film?
I think it's a very strong film. It's a very engaging film. I think what it does particularly well, there's a clip very early on where Angela Davis, the great black activist, is saying, we need to make the personal, political. And this is exactly what this film does. It starts with this opening montage of footage from various tapes that Damani Baker, the director, has found in, I think, the garage of his mother when he was moving her house, when she was moving house. Yeah, and you know, so you've got footage from, you know, 83, 99, 2015, all spliced together. And you get a sense of a young man, young filmmaker, piecing these disparate frames and images together, trying to work out what they represent. But it does so in a way that's incredibly casual. It doesn't feel like a serious history lesson. It feels like you've been invited over to someone's house on a Sunday morning. They're telling you about their family history over coffee and cake. It's sort of deceptively casual, but it does build to a much bigger picture of American life and black American life in particular.
And Lee, if I could turn to you now, why is it important to revisit these topics? And we see like a trove of sort of documentaries coming out about black power movements, and we've covered quite a few on this show with the Black Panther Party and so forth. What relevance does it have today?
Yeah, it's great relevance. And I think when you look at the historical film that we have, particularly with films like this, it's surprising how much contemporary resonance it has with the situation of African-American communities today in America. But it also speaks, I think, that film to a broader narrative. And it's this perpetual search within the African diaspora for that home, that place, that belonging. And wherever it is, from wherever our particular roots are, we have a deep need to be reconnected. And I think that what you're looking at is African Americans seeking to escape the predations of Jim Crow, you know, racism and its legacies in America, going to Grenada, and then finding themselves at the end of an imperialist gun. And I thought that was a powerful narrative. You sought to escape racism, but actually you've ended up in a place where American imperialism has rolled up on the Grenadian shores with devastating consequences. And I also think the narrative about black women's leadership role in having to make decisions about their family, where they live, what quality of life they will likely. Those are the kind of conversations that I think are, you know, very deep within black communities of, can we survive here? Will we prosper here? Will our children be treated equally?
That's a very important point to make, and this documentary certainly raises all those issues. It's also a very political film, as you alluded to also. I just want to talk a little bit now about the politics of the film before we move on. So on the one hand, Mike, the official US narrative of the invasion of Grenada was that Grenada's government was working with so-called communist Cuba and wanted to make a base there. And Ronald Reagan, the president at the time, quote, said it was necessary to bring the spirit of freedom and to Grenada in the form of a military strike. But of course, this documentary goes against this narrative, doesn't it, and offers a different perspective.
It does. I think it what it succeeds in doing is presenting this counter, because Damani Baker realizes that when the family moves away from Grenada, goes back to the USA, the image that he sees of Grenada in American media is very different from the image that he saw growing up. And, you know, you're getting the sense that American news media presented Ronald Reagan as this great liberator. You know, he went into Grenada and sorted the situation out, and all of a sudden it's much better for him doing that. And actually, Damani Baker, what he's done by making this film and piecing all these individual pieces of footage together that have been taken over the decades, what he's done is he's actually presented a very convincing counter-image to that claim, and the counter-image to what was the dominant image in American media at the time.
Mm. And I did a bit of more research actually on this topic, because I found it really interesting in the way this documentary brought it up. And it was reported that a senior British officer who watched the Grenada invasion from Barbados, Major Mark Adkin, he wrote afterward, quote, that it was launched because of the intense desire of the president and his advisors to raise U.S. prestige, particularly at home and in the armed forces, where morale and self-respect had fallen substantially since the Vietnam War. Lee, do you think that this was the real reason then behind the invasion?
Well, yeah, there's nothing like crushing a little country to, reinforce one's flagging self-esteem. So that's a narrative we've seen in world politics. But I also think that the you've got to remember that, you know, with Norman Manley in Jamaica at the time, that there was a very much sense that there might be a domino effect in relation to socialism, communism in the region.
The US perceived this as a threat.
The US perceived this as a very real threat that could see a swathe of Caribbean islands really moving to the left. Not far from their coast. And so a combination of hubris, arrogance, imperialism, and real genuine fear, I think, of the extent to which the Caribbean could be involved, fueled American ambition to try and stamp out any nascent light of an alternative socialist agenda in the region.
Hello, my name is Damani Baker. I am the director of The House on Cocoa Road, a documentary about my mother. My mom moved my sister and I from Oakland, California, where I was born and raised, to take part in the Grenada Revolution. So this film was about how we ended up in Grenada in the first place, how we ended up in a country that eventually would be invaded by the United States as my family hid under a bed when bombs dropped all around us. In order to understand that, I had to go back and retrace my mother's history, her story. Her story of having parents who were part of the Great Migration West, great-grandparents who were sharecroppers in the South, how she served children in the Black Panther Party's pre-breakfast program, and eventually became Angela Davis' teaching assistant at UCLA in the 60s. So this is a film about women leaders, it's about my mother, and it's about people who really imagined a better way to live.
So that was Damani Baker there himself speaking about the purpose of this film. And I think what's special about this documentary, and also quite unique, is that it offers, as well as being a political film, it offers an intimate look at Damani's personal life. What do you make of this sort of aspect of the film? Was it important?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it sort of falls into that kind of who do you think you are, that kind of the TV series where people look back into their roots. So it starts out as Damani Baker looking back and trying to figure out how on earth his family got here from there. So, you know, his great-grandmother was part of a sharecropping family in the American South, and there was Great Migration, then civil rights, you know, the advances in civil rights. And he's trying to piece out where he falls and how come that he, as a young filmmaker, you know, has the time, the leisure time, and the money to go around the world making movies, and you know.
Even the title of the film, *The House on Cocoa Road*, has a personal touch, doesn't it?
Yes, it's trying to sort of pin down places in the past and to sort of plot a, if you like, a sort of straight line. You know, how do we get here now in this moment, given everything that's gone before us, and given the indifference of white America to our family and our struggles? You know, how do we get through all that to get to where we are today? And you know, the archive footage is very important in sort of nailing down exactly where that family was at those particular times.
I suppose this is a very symbolic message then, Lee, that politics is kind of inseparable to black African Americans and their life and their struggle to the present day.
Absolutely, deeply intertwined, and we very much live our lives vicariously through those politics. But I think it's also an interesting narrative on the phenomenon of migration in the modern world, and how those migratory tales can be best be told by the sort of intimate portrait of an individual or group of individuals who are seeking to make a better life for themselves and often escape, you know, horrendous and circumstances. So I think it speaks to that broader narrative. And within that, there's the African diaspora, which scattered across the four ends of the earth, is in a perpetual search for his own identity, his own place in the world, and very much the stepping stones from Africa to the West are seen as important steps along that story.
And that reminds me actually of what you were saying of the main protagonist in this documentary, Damani Baker's mother. Yeah. What did you make of her contribution, Mike?
It's very important that actually the bulk of the voices that you hear in this documentary are female. So it's Fanny, it's her friends and her neighbours in Granada. It's about women trying to make a life for themselves and trying to raise a family. And it's also, the film itself is the work of a son trying to pay tribute to a mother who raised him right. And I mean, that's why it's so emotional and so affecting at the end of the day.
To ask Sister Angela to make a few brief introductory remarks.
I'm here in pre-Grenada for the very first time. The experiences that I've had here in Grenada have confirmed in a very powerful way where we are headed, what the future of the entire planet ought to look like. This beautiful, powerful militant revolution.
My sister Fania and I were so excited by what we saw. We were so struck by the enthusiasm of the not only the leaders, but the everyday people. For us, Grenada, especially for black people, really marked a new moment in history.
It just sort of captured the imagination of us. Here's a socialist government. A revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
It was legendary activist Angela Davis, Walton and scholar and activist and was a member of the Black Panther Party. Now, Lee, in the film, Granada was described by black people as being a sort of utopia for black people, and Maurice Bishop, the Prime Minister at the time, who was tragically later shot dead, said if we have 95% of predominantly African origin in our country, then we can have a dangerous appeal to 30 million black people in the United States. So So why was there such a longing from African Americans for sort of this a strong black community and leadership?
I think very much African Americans had coming out of the Vietnam War were beginning to reassess their place in society. They'd taken part in the Olympics, they'd fought in world wars, and yet they were still facing the horrendous police brutality and economic discrimination in the land of the home of the free and the land of the brave. And I think they began to fundamentally reassess, or at least some did, reassess the extent to which they could prosper in such societies. And as all African diasporas do, they looked elsewhere in the world where their fortunes might be greater. And of course, there's a deep longing and sort of Garveyan sense of the Jamaican leader Marcus Garvey to build black nation, to build an example of how humanity can work together in a progressive way. And very much the ideals of Cuba and the Grenada revolutionary movement encapsulated for very many black diasporans, African diasporans, their desire to see black nationhood, to see progressive socialism encapsulated and led by, you know, not just Cuba, but joined in by other islands in and around the Caribbean. And as such, it elevated itself into a international country of appeal, where the revolutionary movement put out a worldwide appeal for Africans in the diaspora to come help rebuild Grenada and be part of that movement. And lots of people from the United Kingdom, from the United States, other parts of the world, responded to that call.
That's very revealing indeed. I don't think many people know about this aspect of Grenada from the black perspective.
Yeah.
And just speaking of that, Mike, I think also what's invaluable of Baker's documentaries, this archive material he has that juxtaposes sort of the propaganda, and he touches on the role of the media. Mm-hmm. What is life like? How was life painted for black people in Grenada, the reality of it?
Well, I mean, this is one of the important facets of this particular film. You get a sense of a place that is trying to, I think the phrase that Maurice Bishop uses, to throw off the Coca-Cola mentality and you know, go in a different direction. And so you do get the footage that we get here that was taken by Damani Baker's own family is very much from the ground up. You're seeing, you know, a kind of grassroots movement building. You know, you're seeing people, you know, taking control of their own destinies in a way that clearly threatened the Reagan administration. And you get this sort of strange sort of contrast between Angela Davis and that particular way of thinking and the Ronald Reagan way of thinking, which, you know, is a little, shall we say, slightly more fearful.
Resonates a lot with today.
I think so. And you know, those contrasts, yes, do have a resonance in what's going on in America today with the way certain white leaders are espousing their values.
You're not naming any names.
Not naming any names. No.
Well, we'll have to move swiftly on just for now.
Do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
All of a sudden, the drugs came in so heavy, it was scary, but it destroyed the entire city of Oakland. I mean, there's some discussion now where that came from. Entire black communities were destroyed. With all of my efforts to put you in a good school and try to balance it, there was still, we could sit on that hill in East Oakland and hear gunfire all down the hill all night.
It was very disappointing to see all the work that we've done being overrun by drugs. It was not a happy time in the black community anywhere in the States.
That was not an environment to raise children. A bit more of Angela Davis then. We talked a little bit about her, but I'd like to talk about her a little bit more just before we end the show. And Mike, what do you make of her contribution to this documentary?
It's very important. I mean, she turns up very early on in the film because Fanny Damani Baker's mother was a student of hers at the
UCLA.
UCLA, yes. and later became her assistant. So it's almost about the role of mentoring in American life, and how having a good mentor can, you know, change the way you think about the world, change the way you perceive the world. And I think Angela Davis becomes almost Fanny's mentor, you know, and takes her to protests and leads her into a more engaged way of thinking about the world.
And the documentary sheds light on her fair share of struggle, Angela Davis, in her life for racial equality. What does she mean for black activists everywhere?
Hugely symbolic figure for black activists worldwide. Continues to be an inspiration today for the millennials who you see in the Black Lives Matter movement and wider. African women on the continent still revere Angela Davis. She's held in extraordinarily high regard right across the world. And quite rightly so, when you think about the radical stance that she took, putting herself in danger, risking jail, risking a loss of her life, all for the principled struggle for justice and equality. Angela Davis, you know, remains a very sort of bright, burning firmament on the skyline. And she will be revered, I think, for a long time to come.
And what I found inspiring, actually, from this documentary was watching her leadership and how the black unions at the time in the 80s organized. Do you think movements today can learn a lot about that era?
Well, we look at the post-Weinstein movement and the Me Too movement, and we realize just how far we've got to come. People have to realize when Angela Davis was doing what she was doing, we were talking about 1970s, late 60s America, where the kind of super black machismo was still very much of the sort of shaft, you know, militant young black man was still the focus of the struggle. And along comes Angela Davis, and in one stroke, recenters that struggle, putting black women at the heart of that movement. It was revolutionary at the time, and when you look back on it, you have to appreciate just how significant it really was.
And Mike, we're running towards the end of the show now. I just wanted to get your final thoughts on this film, and would you recommend it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I found it, you know, inspirational. I found it very engaging. I also found it very educational. I mean, I've not seen much treatment, cinematic treatment, of the events in Grenada. So to have a, you know, a first-hand perspective, to have people who are actually on the ground at the time telling the story in their own words, in this very laid-back, you know, very informal way, it was an education for me.
And Lee, if I could turn to you, your final thoughts, and would you recommend this film?
Definitely recommend the film. I think that anything that captures that sort of historical narrative from the victim perspective is going to offer really unique insights for people, and also for people to get a real appreciation of how important globally the Grenadian Revolution was to Africans right across the world.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, A maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام: المؤمن أصلب من الجبل، الجبل يستقل منه، والمؤمن لا يستقل من دينه شيء.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The believer is harder than a mountain, for the mountain is dispensable, whereas nothing can separate the believer from his religion."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the very interesting dialogues and conversations in the historical texts of the Muslims a dialogue between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and Zurara. Zurara was one of the very famous companions of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. He was very well respected by Imam al-Baqir, and he was very well respected by Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam as well. Now, in this conversation between Zurara and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, we find that Zurara asked Imam al-Baqir, "What is the meaning of al-Hanafiyya?" Now, here, Hanafi, of course, what is meant is not the Sunni sect of Islam, but rather when we talk about Prophet Ibrahim, or we talk about the prophets after Prophet Isa, Prophet Jesus, all the way up to Prophet Muhammad, there is this time in between which is called that the people followed the Hanaf religion or the Hanafi religion, right? And so they're called that they were on the path of Hanaf. So, for example, the parents of the Holy Prophet, or the great-grandparents of the Holy Prophet, and so on and so forth, they were the Hanafi deen, the deen ul-Hanif. Prophet Ibrahim is also said to be on this deen ul-Hanif, the religion of Hanif. So Zurara asks Imam al-Baqir, "What is the meaning of this al-Hanif or al-Hanafiyya?" Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam replies in this conversation that it is the nature Allah has created in human beings. Allah has created this Hanafi in human beings so that they can recognize Allah. So this Hanafi religion, dear friends, is meant to be Islam. It is that nature which Allah has created in human beings, in every single human being, which allows and really makes aware a human being in order to recognize Allah. And so it is this Hanif religion which the great-grandparents and the grandparents of the Holy Prophet were on, this innate perfection within every human being, which allows them to recognize that Allah exists. There is a God. A very beautiful conversation, a very deep and profound conversation, speaking about a concept which is very seldomly spoken about, the Hanif religion. This innate nature, this fitrah that every human being has, which pulls them towards Allah, which helps them recognize Allah, which tells them that there is Allah. Very beautiful words exchanged in this dialogue between Zarara and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
When we remember our fifth imam, we remember an important part of the recommendations of the fifth imam, which I would like to narrate for you in this regard, which he gave to his famous companion, Jabir Ju'fi. He told him, the fifth imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, to him, I'm going to give you tips, Imam al-Baqir says, things, remember them. Imam alayhi salam says, وَإِنْ خَانُوكَ فَلَا تَخُنْ. If you're betrayed, if you're stabbed in the back, then you don't stab in the back. Do you see why? The Imam alayhi salam is saying, as a follower of the Ahl al-Bayt, we can't use the excuse, well, they did it, I have to also. Does it look good for me? If I don't respond in the same way, it looks weak on me. Imam alayhi salam says, it is not about what people will say, it's about how you be judged by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, if you are the subject of betrayal, do not yourself betray. وَإِن كُذِّبْتَ فَلَا تَغْضَبْ. If they dismiss you and they say you are a liar, yes, and they constantly disbelieve in what you say, don't get angry. لَا تَغْضَبْ. Don't lose your cool. Imam al-Baqir, Imam al-Sadiq, when they were debating these people, the atheists and the agnostics, did they lose their cool? Sometimes years they would sit with them. Okay, you don't want to believe? No problem. It's up to you. وَإِن مُدِحْتَ فَلَا تَفْرَحْ. When you are praised, never be happy. Don't think that when people praise you, don't let it get to you. Don't make it as a sense to boast your ego and your desire for yourself. وَإِن ذُمِمْتَ فَلَا تَجْزَعْ. When you are criticized, don't give up. When you are told, for example, you're not doing a good job, continue. Improve yourself.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.